Well, good afternoon to all of you. I do mean all of you. I think there are about 181 here, which is about maximum seating capacity, it seems. Although I see some signs down here reserved for a speaker. All right, there are a few extra chairs, three chairs right down here in the front row. In fact, I see a number of chairs in the front row. Just alerting our ushers to the fact that we have plenty of seating down in the front row here. I wonder why that's always left empty here. Well, it's good to see so many old friends. We've been here in Florida for 32 years, and in that time we pastored many of the congregations here in South Florida and Central Florida, and we probably know about 90% of you, I would say. And there aren't too many feast sites that you can go to where you know most of the people, especially if you're transferring on into a new site. So it's really wonderful to see some of you. I left the Miami-West Palm Beach area about 10 years ago, and some of you I haven't seen in 10 years, and it does make a little difference here. It's interesting there. I know that the common refrain I hear in people meeting after many years of absence is, boy, you look good. And whenever I hear that, I just think of what George Burns used to say about that. There are three stages of life: childhood, middle age, and boy, you look good. Oh, you're still alive? Well, you look good for alive here. So certainly looking forward to renewing many acquaintances with you here. This is a very special day for us, that is, in the Demarest family, for two reasons. One is, of course, first and foremost, that it is God's first holy day of the Feast of Tabernacles here, High Holy Day, sixth holy day of the year. And it is also the day on which our youngest son was born. 43 years ago, back in 1974, here, he was born during the Feast of Tabernacles. For you who are thinking about the timing of that. And it was a feast that I and my two sons at the time went to in Mount Pocono, and I left my wife home expecting to deliver any day. That was, I think, one of the most difficult trips I ever made. I had a key responsibility at the feast. I had a speaking assignment, and in those days, some of you remember those days, that was the way it was. So I left, and that was a very difficult thing for me to do, to leave with her expecting any day. And all she had was the doctor's phone number, who would be coming to the house for the delivery, and that was it. All the members were gone. Everybody basically we knew was gone. So we got up there, and the third day of the feast, after I had got things in order and given the speaking assignment that I had at the time, I decided I'm going down to see my wife. I don't care, you know, what anyone says here. And so I went down. It was only a 3-4 hour drive to Lancaster County in Pennsylvania, where we lived. And when I got there, it was only a short time after that, she said, "Call the doctor." And so we called the doctor, and over she came and says, "This baby's coming today." The baby was born that night, 10 pounds, 1 ounce. Shortly after the birth, my wife said to me, "Our family is now complete." So I got the message that day, and then I stayed all that next day and went back up. I had my middle son now, with me. He was 3 years old, and we went back up to Mount Pocono, and we had a minister's luncheon the next day, and we had a Polaroid picture, and I was talking to Ted Armstrong at the time, and he said, "Oh, what did he weigh?" And I said, 10 pounds, 1 ounce. And he said, "That must have hurt." So we have very fond memories of that so long ago. They're all in their 40s now here. I would like to welcome all of our visitors that are here that are not from Central or South Florida. In fact, I'm just curious, how many of you are from a state other than Florida? Yeah, see? Look at that. How many of you are from out of the United States? Yes, I know there were at least a few. I know that our extended family has three from France. Our daughter-in-law's brother is here, Raphael Bernal, and his wife Sarah, and little Max with them. And I see another hand or two, so you might want to get around and circulate and see if you can meet everyone who's here. And did you ever take foreign language in school? Any of you ever take French in high school? You know, like 30, 40, 50 years ago? Well, here's your chance to practice here, you know. Go up and see what you remember. And I can pretty well sum it up in one word in French. Rien. Nothing. Almost nothing. But it is, I think, interesting to try. So we certainly welcome them here with us today. Concerning the seniors' luncheon here, or brunch, I guess we call it. It's interesting, 65 years of age and over. Well, I was the pastor of Ocala for a while, and they have an annual seniors' luncheon there, but you have to be 75 to get in. And so I'm not old enough to go to that one yet here. But I heard they told me that that was all Mr. Thompson's doing. He was the pastor before me, that you had to be 75 there. So, but this is a wonderful day, as I said, in many ways. I'd like to begin today with a few questions, kind of a survey in a sense. How many former presidents of the United States are attending with us today? Would you raise your hands, please? Well, there are five. There's not a single one here? All right, I thought I saw Bill Clinton before, but that turned out to be Mr. Thompson. But I should have known he wasn't tall enough. Well, are there any former presidents, prime ministers, or heads of state of any country here today? Ushers, do you see any hands? No? All right, let's see. Are there any former or present governors of any of the states of the United States here today? Ooh, this is not going well. Are there any present or former United States senators with us today? Are there any present or former mayors of a major United States city like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles here today? Not one? Well, perhaps I should try something other than politics. Are there any former or present generals of the military here today? Are there any CEOs of companies that have more than 10,000 employees here today? Well, let me try once more. Anyone here who has recently made Forbes' list of the richest people in the world? Now, they list 400. There's bound, Bob, say there's bound to be one here if there are 400. Maybe you're just too modest for that. Well, let me expand the question. Is there anyone here who's ever made the list of the Forbes' richest people in the world ever? Maybe you did and you lost it all. Not a one. Well, I don't know what we're going to do. We don't have one governor, one United States senator, one mayor, one general, one CEO, or one really, really, I mean billionaire type person here. How in the world are we going to be able to fulfill the calling that God has given us to be the governors, leaders, and CEOs of the world in the time that we are here portraying, the thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ on this earth. How will we do that with so little experience in this group, and I would assume in all of the assembled groups of God around the world, so little experience in such things? I guess I should have known that no one would raise a hand to these questions today. Of course, I knew that already. After all, God did tell us the type of people generally that he would call and train for these positions of responsibility. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26 gives us this description. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God has chosen the foolish of the world to confound the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty. And base things of the world and things which are despised has God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Have we ever looked at these descriptions in detail as to what these descriptions actually meant in the language in which they were inspired? It's not a pretty picture. It's not a very complimentary picture. Foolish is the Greek word moros, and it means, according to Strong's Concordance, dull, stupid. That's not my word, please. That's right there in the commentary. Heedless morally, or, and I particularly like this one, blockhead. Blockhead. Weak is asthenes, and it means without strength, feeble, impotent, or sick. And base is agones, and it means ignoble, dishonorable in purpose and character, of low quality. God apparently wasn't looking for a few good men and women by any of the standards that this world would use or companies would use to find employees. Companies today want the best and the brightest, not blockheads. They don't want the feeble or people of low quality. They don't even make the first cut. Why would he choose such people as we apparently are then? 1 Samuel 16, verse 7 certainly gives us the answer to that and the key. But the Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance, on his credentials in the world, or on the height of his stature, how successful he is, how high he has risen in this world, because I have refused him. For the Lord sees not as man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, a man looks at the credentials, the degrees after his name, the experience he has in business, how much money he's made for his clients, but the Lord looks on the heart. The heart. God is looking for the right raw material for him to work with, and we are, according to 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26, raw material. The exact reason God called each of us is a mystery. I haven't figured it out yet, why he would choose me and not my next-door neighbor, but it's a mystery. Other than the fact that none of us was among the mighty, powerful, or really famous of this world. He called the weak of the world who would hopefully realize that to fulfill the awesome job he has for us, we would need a lot of help. We were in dire need of God's assistance. In fact, so much help that he has given us a head start by calling us now as his first fruits. Today we're going to give some attention to that process whereby God can take the weak of the world and develop them into the leaders of the world tomorrow. Let's consider the task that will be given to us when Jesus Christ returns to this earth. In Obadiah 21, that's not chapter, that's verse. In Obadiah 21, let me help you. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. Obadiah is easy to miss. It's one of the white pages in our Bible. It's not used very often. Obadiah, verse 21, speaking of the time of Christ's return, it says in this verse, "And saviors," other translations have "deliverers, shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's." Herbert Armstrong nearly always began his sermons at the Feast of Tabernacles by putting this sixth festival in the context of the first five. I can't remember a sermon where he didn't do that. If he was speaking about the day of Pentecost, he would put that in the context of the ones that came before it. So let me give us a little context. The Feast of Trumpets pictures the time of Christ's return at the moment just before the two great armies of this earth, the King of the North and the powers to the north and east of Jerusalem, bound by the river Euphrates, they're gathering together at Armageddon, and they would have destroyed themselves and all life from the face of the earth if Christ didn't return at that time. This battle, that is, at Armageddon, was preceded by a time of terrible trouble, the worst religious deception, the worst wars, the worst famines, the worst disease epidemics, and the worst tribulation that this earth has ever seen. Satan had been cast down again from heaven. And when he tried to make war against God and persecute, he went to persecute this earth because of his great anger and realization that his time was short, we're told in the book of Revelation. And he vents his fury on this earth. A spirit of anger and rage will grip this earth in the end time, and we're seeing the beginnings of that today. Instead of a lone gunman shooting innocent people, nation will rise against nation, and associations of nations and will rise up against associations of other nations, and with a spirit of rage and hatred behind them, they will battle for the domination of the world. That is the time setting in the book of Revelation. The Day of Atonement pictures the time that God will restrict this spirit behind these things for 1,000 years, and the world will finally begin to realize who the real power behind the troubles of this earth for 6,000 years really has been. Even though there are two great reasons to rejoice, the return of Christ, the binding of Satan, there will be at this time a great silence and a great solemnity across the face of the earth. The storm has passed. The help is about to arrive. But the earth lies in ruins, and the survivors of it all are in desperate straits. Not unlike the aftermath of a great storm, which some of us have experienced recently. The people of Puerto Rico are still dealing with it, but it's going to be on a worldwide basis, that type of setting. The survivors of these events will be in need of help. Help 1,000 times more challenging than anything FEMA has ever dealt with or encountered. This time, in this moment, is why God called us to the faith. To preach the gospel, yes, to the world, and to prepare to rule on this earth. Proverbs 12 and verse 24. The hand of the diligent shall bear rule. That is the title of the sermon today. The hand of the diligent shall bear rule. We are being trained now for this responsibility. We may have been the weak of the world when God called us, but he does not expect us to stay that way. Luke 19, verse 11. In Luke 19, verse 11. And as they heard these things, he spoke a parable because he was nigh to Jerusalem and because they thought the kingdom of God should immediately appear. He said, therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and said unto them, occupy till I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a message after him saying, we will not have this man reign over us. And it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, that he commanded these servants to be called unto him, to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. And we know, all of us, I believe, what these things represent. Then came the first, saying, Lord, your pound has gained 10 pounds. And he said unto him, well, you good servant, because you have been faithful in very little, little tiny bit of responsibility, have you authority over 10 cities? Now, if you tried to run for election today as a mayor or a governor and said, well, I've had the responsibility of sweeping the floors in this building, and I've done it faithfully for 10 years, you think that would qualify you? This is what it's saying. Since you have had been faithful in very little, God is going to give us authority over a great amount. How many times have we read these verses and have had them explained to us in sermons? So how well are we doing? How well are we doing? Are we ready to rule 10 cities? Anyone here? Ready? Now? What if your assignment as the millennium begins is just one city, just one? Let's make it easy. One city. Let's say Fort Myers, just one city. Or how about Miami? How would you like Miami? Or San Juan, Puerto Rico? Would you like that one at the moment? Our president thinks maybe we need a new mayor down there anyway. What if it were Calcutta in India or Hong Kong or Beijing? That's just one city. Are any of us ready for that? Do you expect to be ready when Jesus Christ returns? Do you expect to be ready? Does the Bible reveal to us how, and I'm just picking a name out of the hat, Widow Jones? Now, odds are there may be a Widow Jones here today, but I didn't have you in mind. Does the Bible reveal to us how Widow Jones, who has been a dedicated servant of God for many years, will be ready to rule over 10 cities? Does the Bible tell us how that can be done? Her biggest responsibility in the years of her calling may have been to care for a small apartment, which she did very well. Find a way to get to church, which she many times had to depend in faith upon other members to provide for her, pray and study daily for those that needed assistance, and to encourage everyone she met at church services. Those were all of her responsibilities. Then, as Christ assigns the new members of the family of God to be sent out as deliverers and as governors and saviors to the world, she hears her name called Mary Jones. Your assignment is Calcutta. Okay, now what? Do you see my point? Where do we start? Are we really equipped for such a task? Any of us, honestly, are we equipped? Something is missing here that we need to consider, and we will do so for the remainder of the sermon. I offer you hope today, all of us, the weak and base and things that are not of the world, I offer you hope. How will Widow Jones or any of us be able to fulfill these tasks? All I see are question marks and doubts each morning when I get up and I look in the mirror and I see this future leader of 1 or 5 or 10 cities. So let me rephrase the question slightly, and then I think we'll have our answer. The question isn't how will I be ready for these things, but how will God enable us to be able to do such things? How will God equip us to be able to do such things? 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 35. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 35. But some man will say, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come? Well, this person's been dead for 1,000 years. Where is he? Well, you could say, well, he's in that grave. Well, no, he's not, because in 1,000 years, he's dust. I mean, and there's been erosion, and probably the earth has sunk more than 6 feet and blown in the wind, and all those little pieces and particles of dirt are now spreading through the atmosphere and maybe all over the entire earth. Where is he? If you just look at it physically, where is he? And with what body do they come? Where is the body? There isn't any. You know, after so many years, there really isn't anybody unless you happen to be one of the few pharaohs that died. The question for us is, what is God going to do to our weak and feeble bodies in the resurrection? What is he going to do? 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 40. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 40. There are also celestial bodies and bodies terrestrial. We have terrestrial bodies now, in case you're wondering which one you had at the moment here. And the older we all get older, but some of us seem to get older and understand it more. The older we get, the more gravity pulls us down. Do you notice that? Gravity is really, really a problem for people that get older. Eventually, we know, all of us to the dust of the ground. If you think, you still look pretty good at 60, then try my wife's experiment, and that is put a mirror on the floor, bend down, and look at your face as it looks down toward the floor. Or your body, lots of things hanging. Not 20 years old anymore, gravity is winning. But the glory of the celestial is one, the glory of the terrestrial is another. There is one glory of the sun, of the moon, another glory of the stars. One star differs from another in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. Our body, that when we leave this life, many times is pretty corrupt. It's pretty weak. It's pretty frail. It's got many issues and flaws and defects with it. But in the resurrection, it will be flawless and without defect. Perfect. Perfect. Everyone perfect. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power, energized beyond anything we have ever experienced in this life. Even as a 16-year-old teenager who thinks he can conquer the world, you know, and thinks he's Tarzan or Superman. Energized. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. And the difference between the two is enormous. Enormous. You at the peak of your physical vitality are nothing compared to the body that's going to be given us in the resurrection of the first fruits. At Christ's return, God is going to give the first fruits an upgraded body from the best you ever were. It'll be upgraded from that. How much of an upgraded? It will be like the dirt of the ground compared to glory. Like corruption compared to perfection. Like weakness compared to surging dynamic power. Those weak, feeble, ignoble, low-quality bodies will surge with power, vitality, inspiration, unbridled joy, and overwhelming optimism at the time of the resurrection. The blind will see, we're told, the deaf will hear. If any who died in the faith were blind, they'll see. If they're deaf, they'll hear. The lame will run. The tired will be filled with zeal. The hurting, aching, halting will experience an energy and vibrancy never known in this physical life. It will be the presence of eternal and everlasting life as this mortal body is shed and changed into spirit. And what has got to be the most amazing metamorphosis the world has ever seen. Words fail at this point to adequately describe what this event will be like. We just try to use analogies, but I'm sure they all fall far short. The prophet Isaiah puts it this way in Isaiah chapter 60 and verse 1. Isaiah 60 and verse 1. Rise, shine, for your light has come. And the glory of the Lord is risen upon you. Now, the notes in your Bible, if you have a heading there, will say this refers to Jerusalem. But it also, if you think about it and understand God's plan, first, not just to Jerusalem, which is going to be a great city in the world tomorrow, but to each of the first fruits. Arise out of the grave. Arise and be transformed to glory, and you shall shine. Your light has come, and the glory of God is going to be placed upon us. Verse 5 says, then you shall see and flow together, and your heart shall fear and be enlarged. That's the King James Version. It's a little obscure, so let me read it to you from other translations. In the Jewish translation of the Masoretic text, it says, then you shall see and be radiant, and your heart shall throb and be enlarged. And the New King James Version says, then you shall see and become radiant, and your heart shall swell with joy. Swell up with joy. In Albert Barnes' notes on the entire Bible, he makes clear why the New King James Version and the Jewish translation are more precise. Or more accurate than the old King James. He writes, quote, the Vulgate, Septuagint, Chaldee, Syriac, Arabic, and other manuscripts all render it in accordance with the present reading of the Hebrew text. That the effect would be to cause the heart to overflow with joy. Has your heart ever overflowed with joy? I mean, right up to the point where it would burst. I'd settle most days for my tank of joy being, you know, 1/8 full. But to overflow with joy. He goes on concerning the expression and flow together. Quote, this translation, it is believed, by no means conveys the true sense of the passage. Indeed, it is difficult to make sense of the translation. But it may be used in the sense of flowing or overflowing with joy, or it may seem to shine, to be bright, and thence to be cheered, to rejoice, as when the countenance is bright and cheerful. So I, again, don't think we can imagine in our minds the time when God changes this body from flesh to spirit, from corruption to incorruption, what it is that we're going to experience and know and feel and understand. It's beyond anything. Take, you know, the greatest moment of your life and multiply it many times over. Putting this all together means that our physical bodies are going to be upgraded 1,000 times and over. I could have picked any number, a million, a billion, a trillion, a quadrillion, a centillion, or whatever it is. How do you quantify it? But that is just the beginning of God enabling us to go out into a world in ruins and lying in devastation and rebuilding the waste places of the earth along with its survivors. What are the survivors of all those things going to be like? What will be their mental frame of mind? You see on the news interviews of people in Puerto Rico. People lost their homes in the Houston area. people that were devastated in other hurricanes, and you just see they're in despair. So we lost everything, everything. That's going to be around the entirety of the earth at the time Christ returns. Lucifer was given great authority and power originally, but he failed. Why? He lacked the character of God. He had great power. He had great energy. You know, he had great vitality, but he lacked something. So there's something more than a body, more than power, that is the key to our understanding. His mind was not set on serving God. So in God's plan for preparing this earth's future leaders, he called the first fruits to develop the very mind of Christ. That is the greatest construction project this world has ever seen. Human beings, the weak of the world, developing the mind of Jesus Christ. Philippians 2 verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Jesus Christ. I like the French translation of that verse because it translates mind there as les sentiments, the sentiments, the attitude, the motive. The attitude and the motive beyond just the physical things people do, because people can do some wonderful things, but God, remember, in 1 Samuel says he looks on the heart. What was the motive for doing even a wonderful deed? What was the motive? That's more important to God than the outward appearance. So Satan lacked that trait, certainly. Some of us have been working on this for a long time, 50 years and more. Some getting up near 60 years. My wife will be up near her 60th Feast of Tabernacles here soon, I think next year. That's a long time, that many years, to be working on these things. So how close are we, how close are you, each one of us here, 181 of us, to possessing the perfect mind of Christ? How close are we? I would say the answer to that is about as close as we are as having a body that will never die and never be tired again. About that close. Which means not close at all. Even though we may eat our veggies and exercise daily, the best we are in our physical presence is nothing in comparison to the glorified body that Jesus Christ is going to give to us at the return of him to this earth. So let's think about this for a moment. If God is going to upgrade our bodies to something far more spectacular and dynamic, would he not need to do the same to our minds and our abilities? Wouldn't that be a need? Who here has the kind of training to rule over 10 cities now? Not a one of us. But God can equip us for the task, and he will. If we are faithful in a little, he will give us authority over much. Matthew chapter 25 and verse 20. Matthew 25 and verse 20. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, you delivered unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents also. You know, I doubled it all. I'm twice as good at this and twice as good at that and twice whatever. Behold, I've gained beside them 5 talents more. And his Lord said unto him, well done, you good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a very few things. And that is what most of us deal with, being faithful over very few things in the scheme of this whole world. I will make you ruler. Notice, I will make you the ruler. I will enable this to take place. I will make you ruler over many things. enter you into the joy of your Lord. I mean, that says it all, doesn't it? I will do this through you. And God can do it. Putting this together with Luke 19, the parable of the pounds, we know that if we're faithful over the things we deal with in this life, and none of us here has even been a mayor, let alone a governor or a president, Jesus says we will be given rulership over many things, perhaps the supervision of 10 cities. Think about it. Miami, Key West, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach, Fort Myers, Orlando, Sarasota, Lakeland, Tampa, and St. Petersburg. That's 10. There you go. I think I might take a stab at Possum Trot and Lickin' Skillet and Monkey's Eyebrow in Kentucky. But I don't know about Miami, West Palm Beach, you know, Orlando. Wow, Orlando closed on the Sabbath. Whoa. How will that work? Luke chapter 12 and verse 11. Luke chapter 12 and verse 11. And when they bring you into the synagogues and unto the magistrates and powers, take you no thought how or what thing you will answer or what you shall say. Don't worry about anything that you might have to say under the most adverse circumstances. For the Holy Spirit shall teach you in the same hour what you shall say. God will give you the words to speak. Here is God enabling someone on the spur of the moment to say the correct thing at a very difficult time. I remember Mr. Waterhouse saying many years ago when he was just starting out as a speaker, he was with Mr. Armstrong somewhere, and Mr. Armstrong was scheduled to speak. And Mr. Armstrong wasn't feeling well. He called Gerald up and he said, "Well, you'll have to fill in for me today." And that was like 10 minutes before the services started. This was before he had all of his experience. And so he said he took his Bible, and the only thing he could think of to take with him is, a quick prayer. "God help me, you know, inspire my mind and direct me, because it's going to be awful if you don't." God wants us to prepare, but sometimes we're put on the spot, and all we can say is, "God, help me to do this, because, you know, I can't unless you do." Another example, Acts chapter 2, verse 14. "But Peter, standing up with 11, lifted up his voice, said unto them, 'You men of Judea, and all of you that dwell in Jerusalem, be this known unto you, and hearken to my words.'" And then he proceeds, as you all know, to give this dynamic sermon that literally turns the world upside down, basically. But just 7 weeks before this, he didn't have the courage to even say that he knew Jesus. I would like to sign up for that speech class, that homiletics class that taught him so much in 7 weeks, where he went from being afraid of public speaking or of identifying with Jesus to being willing to put his life on the line in just 7 weeks. Where did that come from? God equipped him. God equipped him to do that. And perhaps the greatest example of all in the scriptures of God equipping us to rule is found in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 5. 1 Kings 3 and verse 5. "In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, 'Ask what I shall give you.'" What do you think Widow Jones would ask for if she hears Jesus Christ tell her she's assigned to Calcutta? Probably the exact same thing that Solomon asked for. You know the story. I don't need to go through and rehearse it with you. In fact, I spoke about it in previous feasts, sermons. Solomon asked for what he needed in order to rule over the cities of Israel. He asked for a gift to be able to do that. He said, "I can't do this. I can't think of a better request to ask of God after he might say to you or me, 'I'm sending you to Baghdad and Mosul,' just two little cities. No problem. No problem at all. Baghdad and Mosul here. Would we not ask God for the same help that Solomon asked for? Will God give us the help we need at that time? Matthew chapter 7, verse 9. Matthew 7, verse 9. Or what man is there of you whom if his son asks bread will give him a stone? Or if he asks a fish will give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father, which is in heaven, give good things to them that ask him? Would he turn down such a request? Help me to be a leader to these people so that I can help them become the people that you want them to be? Do you think he would turn down that request? 1 Kings 3, verse 12 tells us that God was very pleased with this request from Solomon, and it said, Behold, I have done according to your words. Lo, I have given you a wise and understanding heart. I give this to you. You don't have it. It's not that you aren't smart. You're already smart, but I'm giving you this gift. So there was none like you, and after you shall any arise like unto you. Solomon was already a smart, savvy individual, but he received this gift from God, and in an instant he became the wisest, most knowledgeable person on earth as a gift from God to rule over the cities and people of Israel. God is omniscient, meaning he knows everything. Everything. If he were on Jeopardy, he would never be off of Jeopardy. He'd have the maximum point total from every show, and no one would want to go on Jeopardy. He knows everything, and he can impart to us whatever we need to know to equip us for the task he gives us. 1 Kings 4, verse 29. 1 Kings 4 and verse 29. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all of the children of the east and all of the wisdom of Egypt. For he is wiser than all men, and his fame was in all nations round about. He spoke 3,000 proverbs. His songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke of beasts and of fowl and of creeping things and of fishes. And there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from the kings of the earth, which had heard of his wisdom. And we know of the one example of the Queen of Sheba that visited to have her hardest questions answered. And he did just that. The Jewish commentary by Sansino says, quote, that Solomon far surpassed the Arabs, Chaldeans, and Babylonians in astrological inquiry and scientific learning, and that he knew the medicinal and health value of all plants. Adam Clark's commentary cites these historical references to Solomon's wisdom and knowledge. The wisdom, quote, the wisdom of the East has ever been celebrated. And if we may believe their own best writers, that is, the writers from the East, much of what they possess has been derived from Solomon. Encomiums of his wisdom are everywhere to be met with the Asiatic writers, and his name is famous in every part of the East. Most of the Oriental historians, poets, and philosophers mention Solomon ben Daoud, Solomon, the son of David. And there are many other references listed here for that. In various parts of the Quran, Solomon is spoken of in the terms of highest respect and is represented as a true believer. To just cite a few. Solomon was given the gift of wisdom and knowledge from God so he could rule the nation of Israel well. Jesus Christ, the one who gave him this upgrade of wisdom and knowledge, is not just smarter than all wise men on earth. He is omniscient. That's a term we use often, but I don't think we begin to understand. Omniscient, omnipotent, all-powerful, omnipresent, ever-present, present everywhere. Solomon knew the answers to all of the questions that he was asked. But God knows everything. I've been asked, I used to think every question that anybody could have about the Bible, but I keep getting surprised by people. And the thing is, there are an unlimited number of questions. Every once in a while, somebody will ask something I never heard before. I never thought of that before. Well, God knows everything. We don't have the foggiest idea what it means to be omniscient. God can solve every mathematical problem instantly because he created physics and the universe itself. He made it all. He knows everything. Quantum mechanics is a million times easier to God than 1 + 1. Does it in his head instantly, whatever it is. God knows every person who has ever lived and everything they've ever done and everything they've ever thought. Everyone. Even the deepest secrets, we're told in the book of Kings, even the deepest secrets of people's heart that each individual has never told another soul on the face of the earth, things you keep to yourself, you don't want anyone ever to know. God knows them all. Everyone. It is impossible to quantify God's IQ as it would be the power of, it would be 10 to the power of infinity. Try that one on. All comparisons fail. The difference between the knowledge of God and the smartest person who ever lived, whoever that might be, is millions of times greater than the difference between Stephen Hawking's knowledge of physics and a termite. Look for analogies here. He knows exactly how the universe began. He was there and he started it. I've wondered many times, what was before the universe? What was before God created angels? You ever thought about that? The Bible doesn't give us a hint, does it? But God always was, so there had to be something before he made angels, right? What? We're in for a lot of surprises, I think, a lot. He knows how life began because he was there, he created it. He knows how to make peace between Jew and Arab, Indian and Pakistani, Trump and Pelosi. No, there's a challenge. He even knows how to do that. He knows what happened to Amelia Earhart. He knows where she was, where she is, who killed Kennedy, and where Jimmy Hoffa is buried. Oh, it's going to be interesting, isn't it? Find out all those. Where's Jimmy Hoffa buried? Where was he buried? Oh, wow. See, God already knows. Therefore, God can enable and equip us to rule over 1, 2, 5, 10, 100, 1,000 cities in the world tomorrow if. What is it that we must be doing now so God can equip us in body and mind, so we can teach God's way of life to the nations of the world? It's very simple. Ecclesiastes 12:13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Let's sum it up right here. Fear God, love God, respect God, adore God, and keep his commandments. This is the whole man. This is all there is. In Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And finally, Acts 17:6. And when they found them not, that would be Paul and Silas in this context. They were looking for him. They couldn't find him. So they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, these that have turned the world upside down or come hither also. God called 12 average citizens of the first century and enabled them to turn the whole world upside down. In the beginning of the millennium, God will use former fishermen, farmers, carpenters, secretaries, plumbers, and electricians, and a host of average people, including Widow Jones, whom he called and strengthened and equipped by glorifying their feeble bodies and upgrading their minds to go out into this world as saviors and deliverers, to rebuild the waste places of this earth and to turn the whole world right side up.